long-term success at work often depends on not trying to meet every demand placed on us. The best way to make room for both life and career is to make choices deliberately, to set limits and stick to them. During my first 4 years at Google, I was in the office from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. every day at a minimum. I ran the global operating teams and thought it was critical that I stay on top of as many details as possible. No one ever demanded that I work this schedule. Typical of Silicon Valley, Google was not the type of place to set hours for anyone. Still, the culture in those early days promoted working around the clock. When my son arrived, I wanted to take the 3 months of maternity leave Google offered, but I worried that my job would not be there when I returned. Events leading up to his birth did not put my mind at ease. Google was growing quickly and reorganizing frequently. My team was one of the largest in the company, and coworkers often suggested ways to restructure, which usually meant that they would do more and I would do less. In the months before my leave, several colleagues, all men, ramped up these efforts, volunteering to help run things while I was gone. Some of them even mentioned to my boss that I might not return, so it made sense to start sharing my responsibilities immediately. I tried to take Larry Kanarek's advice and draw my own line. I decided that I wanted to focus entirely on my new role as a mother. I was determined to truly unplug. I even made this decision public, a trick that can help a commitment stick by creating greater accountability. I announced that I was going to take the full 3 months off. No one believed me. A group of my colleagues bet on how long I would be off email after giving birth, with not a single person taking more than 1 week as his or her wager. I would have been offended, except they knew me better than I knew myself. I was back on email from my hospital room the day after giving birth. Over the next 3 months, I was unable to unplug much at all. I checked email constantly. I organized meetings in my living room, during which I sometimes breastfed and probably freaked several people out. I tried to set these gatherings for times when my son would be sleeping, but babies make their own schedules. I went into the office for key meetings, baby in tow. And while I had some nice moments with my son, I look back on that maternity leave as a pretty unhappy time. Being a new mother was exhausting, and when my son slept, I worked instead of rested. And the only thing worse than everyone knowing that I was not sticking to my original commitment was that I knew it too. I was letting myself down. 3 months later, my non-leave maternity leave ended. I was returning to a job I loved, but as I pulled the car out of the driveway to head to the office for my first full day back, I felt a tightness in my chest, and tears started to flow down my cheeks. Even though I had worked throughout my time off, I had done so almost entirely from home, with my son right next to me. Going back to the office meant a dramatic change in the amount of time I would see him. If I returned to my typical 12-hour days, I would leave the house before he woke up and return after he was asleep. In order to spend any time with him at all, I was going to have to make changes and stick to them. I started arriving at work around 9 a.m. and leaving at 5:30 p.m. This schedule allowed me to nurse my son before I left and get home in time to nurse again before putting him to sleep. I was scared that I would lose credibility, or even my entire job, if anyone knew that these were my new in-the-office hours. To compensate, I started checking emails around 5 a.m. Yep, I was awake before my newborn. Then, once he was down at night, I would jump back on my computer and continue my workday. I went to great lengths to hide my new schedule from most people. Camille, my ingenious executive assistant, came up with the idea of holding my first and last meetings of the day in other buildings to make it less transparent when I was actually arriving or departing. When I did leave directly from my office, I would pause in the lobby and survey the parking lot to find a colleague-free moment to bolt to my car. Given my awkwardness, we should all be relieved that I once worked for the Treasury Department and not the CIA. Looking back, I realize that my concern over my new hours stemmed from my own insecurity. Google was hard-charging and hyper-competitive, but it also supported combining work and parenthood, an attitude that clearly started at the top. Larry and Sergey came to my baby shower and each gave me a certificate that entitled me to 1 hour of babysitting. I never used the certificates, and if I could find them, I bet I could auction them off for charity, like lunch with Warren Buffett. Susan Wojcicki, who blazed a trail by having 4 children while being one of Google's earliest and most valuable employees, brought her children to the office when her babysitter was sick. Both my boss, Omid, and David Fisher, the most senior leader on my team, were steadfast supporters and did not allow others to take over parts of my job. Slowly, it began to dawn on me that my job did not really require that I spend 12 full hours a day in the office. I became much more efficient, more vigilant about only attending or setting up meetings that were truly necessary, more determined to maximize my output during every minute I spent away from home. I also started paying more attention to the working hours of those around me. Cutting unnecessary meetings saved time for them as well. I tried to focus on what really mattered. Long before I saw the poster, I began to adopt the mantra, "Done is better than perfect." Done, while still a challenge, turns out to be far more achievable and often a relief. By the time I took my second maternity leave, I not only unplugged, mostly, but really enjoyed the time with both my children. My sister-in-law Amy, a doctor, experienced almost the exact same evolution in attitude. When I had my first child, I worked 12-hour days while trying to pump at work, she told me. I wanted to feel connected to my baby in the limited hours that I was home, so I made myself her sole caregiver many nights. I believed that others were demanding this of me, my bosses at work and my daughter at home. But in truth, I was torturing myself. With the birth of her second child, Amy adjusted her behavior. I took 3 months off and handled my return to work in my own way, on my own terms. And despite what I had previously feared, my reputation and productivity weren't hurt a bit. I deeply understand the fear of appearing to be putting our families above our careers. Mothers don't want to be perceived as less dedicated to their jobs than men or women without family responsibilities. We overwork to overcompensate. Even in workplaces that offer reduced or flex time arrangements, people fear that reducing their hours will jeopardize their career prospects. And this is not just a perception problem. Employees who make use of flexible work policies are often penalized and seen as less committed than their peers. And those penalties can be greater for mothers in professional jobs. This all needs to change, especially since new evidence suggests working from home might actually be more productive in certain cases. It is difficult to distinguish between the aspects of a job that are truly necessary and those that are not. Sometimes the situation is hard to read and the lines are hard to draw. Amy told me about a conference dinner she attended with a group of fellow physicians, including one who had given birth to her first child several weeks earlier. About 2 hours into the meal, the new mom was looking uncomfortable, glancing repeatedly at her cell phone. As a mother herself, Amy was sensitive to the situation. "Do you need to leave and pump?" she whispered to her colleague. The new mom sheepishly admitted that she had brought her baby and her mother to the conference. She was looking at her cell phone because her mother was texting her that the baby needed to be fed. Amy encouraged the new mom to leave immediately. Once she left, the young mother's mentor, an older male physician, admitted that he had no idea that she had brought her baby. If he had known, he would have encouraged her to leave earlier. She was torturing herself unnecessarily. This is one instance where I would have recommended not to sit at the table. Technology is also changing the emphasis on strict office hours, since so much work can be conducted online. While few companies can provide as much flexibility as Google and Facebook, other industries are starting to move in a similar direction. Still, the traditional practice of judging employees by FaceTime rather than results unfortunately persists. Because of this, many employees focus on hours clocked in the office rather than on achieving their goals as efficiently as possible. A shift to focusing more on results would benefit individuals and make companies more efficient and competitive. In his latest book, General Colin Powell explains that his vision of leadership rejects busy bastards who put in long hours at the office without realizing the impact they have on their staff. He explains that, in every senior job I've had, I've tried to create an environment of professionalism and the very highest standards. When it was necessary to get a job done, I expected my subordinates to work around the clock. When that was not necessary, I wanted them to work normal hours, go home at a decent time, play with the kids, enjoy family and friends, read a novel, clear their heads, daydream, and refresh themselves. I wanted them to have a life outside the office. I am paying them for the quality of their work, not for the hours they work. That kind of environment has always produced the best results for me. It is still far too rare to work for someone as wise as General Powell. A related issue that affects many Americans is the extension of working hours. In 2009, married middle-income parents worked about 8.5 hours more per week than in 1979. This trend has been particularly pronounced among professionals and managers, especially men. A survey of high-earning professionals in the corporate world found that 62% work more than 50 hours a week and 10% work more than 80 hours per week. Technology, while liberating us at times from the physical office, has also extended the workday. A 2012 survey of employed adults showed that 80% of the respondents continued to work after leaving the office. 38% checked email at the dinner table, and 69% can't go to bed without checking their inbox. My mother believes that my generation is suffering greatly from this endless work schedule. During her childhood and mine, a full-time job meant 40 hours a week, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. She tells me over and over, "There's too much pressure on you and your peers. It's not compatible with a normal life." But this is the new normal for many of us. The new normal means that there are just not enough hours in the day. For years, I attempted to solve this problem by skimping on sleep, a common but often counterproductive approach. I realized my mistake partially from observing my children and seeing how a happy child can melt into a puddle of tears when he's shy a couple hours of sleep. It turns out that adults aren't much different. Sleeping 4 or 5 hours a night induces mental impairment equivalent to a blood alcohol level above the legal driving limit. Sleep deprivation makes people anxious, irritable, and confused. Just ask Dave. If I could go back and change one thing about how I lived in those early years, I would force myself to get more sleep. It's not only working parents who are looking for more hours in the day. People without children are also overworked, maybe to an even greater extent. When I was in business school, I attended a women in consulting panel with 3 speakers, 2 married women with children, and 1 single woman without children. After the married women spoke about how hard it was to balance their lives, the single woman interjected that she was tired of people not taking her need to have a life seriously. She felt that her colleagues were always rushing off to be with their families, leaving her to pick up the slack. She argued, "My coworkers should understand that I need to go to a party tonight, and this is just as legitimate as their kid's soccer game, because going to a party is the only way I might actually meet someone and start a family so I can have a soccer game to go to one day." I often quote this story to make sure single employees know that they, too, have every right to a full life. My own concerns about combining my career and family rose to the forefront again when I was considering leaving Google for Facebook. I had been at Google for 6.5 years and had strong leaders in place for each of my teams. By then, Google had more than 20,000 employees and business procedures that ran smoothly and allowed me to make it home for dinner with my children almost every night. Facebook, on the other hand, had only 550 employees and was much more of a startup. Late-night meetings and all-night hackathons were an accepted part of the culture. I worried that taking a new job might undermine the balance I had worked hard to achieve. It helped that Dave was working as an entrepreneur in residence at a venture capital firm, so he had almost complete control of his schedule. He assured me that he would take on more at home to make this work for our family. My first 6 months at Facebook were really hard. I know I'm supposed to say challenging, but really hard is more like it. A lot of the company followed Mark's lead and worked night owl engineering hours. I would schedule a meeting with someone for 9 a.m. and the person would not show up, assuming that I meant 9 p.m. I needed to be around when others were, and I worried that leaving too early would make me stand out like a sore and old thumb. I missed dinner after dinner with my kids. Dave told me that he was home with them and they were fine, but I was not. I thought about Larry Kanarek's speech back at McKinsey and realized that if I didn't take control of the situation, my new job would prove unsustainable. I would resent not seeing my family and run the risk of becoming the employee who quit with unused vacation time. I started forcing myself to leave the office at 5:30. Every competitive type A fiber of my being was screaming at me to stay, but unless I had a critical meeting, I walked out that door. And once I did it, I learned that I could. I am not claiming, nor have I ever claimed, that I work a 40-hour week. Facebook is available around the world 24/7, and for the most part, so am I. The days when I even think of unplugging for a weekend or vacation are long gone. And unlike my job at Google, which was based almost exclusively in California, my Facebook role requires a lot of travel. As a result, I have become even more vigilant about leaving the office to have dinner with my children when I'm not on the road. I still struggle with the trade-offs between work and home on a daily basis. Every woman I know does, and I know that I'm far luckier than most. I have remarkable resources, a husband who is a real partner, the ability to hire great people to assist me, both in the office and at home, and a good measure of control over my schedule. I also have a wonderful sister who lives close by and is always willing to take care of her niece and nephew, occasionally at a moment's notice. She's even a pediatrician, so my kids are not just in loving hands, they're in medically trained hands. Not all people are close to their family, either geographically or emotionally. Fortunately, friends can be leaned on to provide this type of support for each other. If there is a new normal for the workplace, there is a new normal for the home, too. Just as expectations for how many hours people will work have risen dramatically, so have expectations for how many hours mothers will spend focused on their children. In 1975, stay-at-home mothers spent an average of about 11 hours per week on primary child care, defined as routine caregiving and activities that foster a child's well-being, such as reading and fully focused play. Mothers employed outside the home in 1975 spent 6 hours doing these activities. Today, stay-at-home mothers spend about 17 hours per week on primary child care, on average, while mothers who work outside the home spend about 11 hours. This means that an employed mother today spends about the same amount of time on primary child care activities as a non-employed mother did in 1975. My memory of being a kid is that my mother was available, but rarely hovering or directing my activities. My siblings and I did not have organized play dates. We rode our bikes around the neighborhood without adult supervision. Our parents might have checked on our homework once in a while, but they rarely sat with us while we completed it. Today, a good mother is always around and always devoted to the needs of her children. Sociologists call this relatively new phenomenon intensive mothering, and it has culturally elevated the importance of women spending large amounts of time with their children. Being judged against the current all-consuming standard means mothers who work outside the home feel as if we are failing, even if we are spending the same number of hours with our kids as our mothers did. When I drop my kids off at school and see the mothers who are staying to volunteer, I worry that my children are worse off because I'm not with them full time. This is where my trust in hard data and research has helped me the most. Study after study suggests that the pressure society places on women to stay home and do what's best for the child is based on emotion, not evidence. In 1991, the Early Childcare Research Network, under the auspices of the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development, initiated the most ambitious and comprehensive study to date on the relationship between child care and child development, and in particular, on the effect of exclusive maternal care versus child care. The research network, which comprised more than 30 child development experts from leading universities across the country, spent 18 months designing the study. They tracked more than 1,000 children over the course of 15 years, repeatedly assessing the children's cognitive skills, language abilities, and social behaviors. Dozens of papers have been published about what they found. In 2006, the researchers released a report summarizing their findings, which concluded that children who were cared for exclusively by their mothers did not develop differently than those who were also cared for by others. They found no gap in cognitive skills, language competence, social competence, ability to build and maintain relationships, or in the quality of the mother-child bond. Parental behavioral factors, including fathers who are responsive and positive, mothers who favor self-directed child behavior, and parents with emotional intimacy in their marriages, influence a child's development 2 to 3 times more than any form of child care. One of the findings is worth reading slowly, maybe even twice. Exclusive maternal care was not related to better or worse outcomes for children. There is, thus, no reason for mothers to feel as though they are harming their children if they decide to work. Children absolutely need parental involvement, love, care, time, and attention. But parents who work outside the home are still capable of giving their children a loving and secure childhood. Some data even suggest that having two parents working outside the home can be advantageous to a child's development, particularly for girls. Although I know the data and understand intellectually that my career is not harming my children, there are times when I still feel anxious about my choices. A friend of mine felt the same way, so she discussed it with her therapist and, later, shared this insight. My therapist told me that when I was worrying about how much I was leaving my girls, that separation anxiety is actually more about the mom than the kids. We talk about it as though it is a problem for children, but actually it can be more of an issue for the mom. I always want to do more for my children. Because of work obligations, I've missed doctor's appointments and parent-teacher conferences and have had to travel when my kids were sick. I haven't missed a dance recital yet, but it probably will happen. I have also missed a level of detail about their lives. I once asked a mother at our school if she knew any of the other kids in the first grade class, hoping for a familiar name or two. She spent 20 minutes reciting from memory the name of every child, detailing their parents, siblings, which class they had been in the year before, and their interests. How could she possibly know all this? Was I a bad mother for not knowing any of this? And why should it even bother me? I knew the answer to that last question. It bothered me because, like most people who have choices, I am not completely comfortable with mine. Later that same year, I dropped my son off at school on St. Patrick's Day. As he got out of the car wearing his favorite blue t-shirt, the same mother pointed out, "He's supposed to be wearing green today." I simultaneously thought, "Oh, who the hell can remember that it's St. Patrick's Day?" And, "I'm a bad mom." Guilt management can be just as important as time management for mothers. When I went back to my job after giving birth, other working mothers told me to prepare for the day that my son would cry for his nanny. Sure enough, when he was about 11 months old, he was crawling on the floor of his room and put his knee down on a toy. He looked up for help, crying, and reached for her instead of me. It pierced my heart. But Dave thought it was a good sign. He reasoned that we were the central figures in our son's life. But forming an attachment to a caregiver was good for his development. I understood his logic, especially in retrospect. But at the time, it hurt like hell. To this day, I count the hours away from my kids and feel sad when I miss a dinner or a night with them. Did I have to take this trip? Was this speech really critical for Facebook? Was this meeting truly necessary? Far from worrying about nights he misses, Dave thinks we are heroes for getting home for dinner as often as we do. Our different viewpoints seem inextricably gender-based. Compared to his peers, Dave is an exceptionally devoted dad. Compared to many of my peers, I spend a lot more time away from my children. A study that conducted in-depth interviews with mothers and fathers in dual-earner families uncovered similar reactions. The mothers were riddled with guilt about what their jobs were doing to their families. The fathers were not. As Marie Wilson, founder of the White House Project, has noted, "Show me a woman without guilt and I'll show you a man." I know that I can easily spend time focusing on what I'm not doing. Like many, I excel at self-flagellation. And even with my vast support system, there are times when I feel pulled in too many directions. But when I dwell less on the conflicts and compromises, and more on being fully engaged with the task at hand, the center holds and I feel content. I love my job and the brilliant and fascinating people I work with. I also love my time with my kids. A great day is when I rush home from the craziness of the office to have dinner with my family and then sit in the rocking chair in the corner of my daughter's room with both of my kids on my lap. We rock and read together. Just a quiet, okay, not always quiet, joyful moment at the end of their day. They drift off to sleep and I drift, okay, run. Back to my laptop. It's also fun when my two worlds collide. For a period of time, Mark hosted Monday night strategy sessions at his house. Because I wouldn't be making it home for dinner, my kids came into the office. Facebook is incredibly family-friendly, and my children were in heaven, entranced by pizza, endless candy, and the huge pile of Legos that the engineers kindly share with young visitors. It made me happy that my kids got to know my colleagues and my colleagues got to know them. Mark had been teaching my son how to fence, so they would sometimes practice with pretend foils, which was adorable. Mark also taught both my kids various office pranks, which was slightly less adorable. I would never claim to be able to find serenity or total focus in every moment. I am so far from that. But when I remember that no one can do it all and identify my real priorities at home and at work, I feel better, and I am more productive in the office and probably a better mother as well. Stanford professor Jennifer Aker's work shows that setting obtainable goals is key to happiness. Instead of perfection, we should aim for sustainable and fulfilling. The right question is not, can I do it all? But, can I do what's most important for me and my family? The aim is to have children who are happy and thriving. Wearing green t-shirts on St. Patrick's Day is purely optional. If I had to embrace a definition of success, it would be that success is making the best choices we can and accepting them. Journalist Mary Curtis suggested in the Washington Post that the best advice anyone can offer is for women and men to drop the guilt trip even as the minutes tick away. The secret is there is no secret. Just doing the best you can with what you've got. In December 2010, I was standing with Pat Mitchell, waiting to go on stage to give my TED Talk. The day before, I had dropped my daughter off at preschool and told her I was flying to the East Coast so I wouldn't see her that night. She clung to my leg and begged me not to leave. I couldn't shake that image, and at the last minute, asked Pat if I should add it to my speech. "Absolutely tell that story," said Pat. "Other women go through this, and you'll help them by being honest that this is hard for you too." I took a deep breath and stepped on stage. I tried to be authentic and shared my truth. I announced to the room, and basically everyone on the internet, that I fall very short of doing it all. And Pat was right. It felt really good not just to admit this to myself, but to share it with others. Chapter 10. Let's start talking about it. Sometimes I wonder what it would be like to go through life without being labeled by my gender. I don't wake up thinking, what am I going to do today as Facebook's female COO? But that's often how I'm referred to by others. When people talk about a female pilot, a female engineer, or a female race car driver, the word female implies a bit of surprise. Men in the professional world are rarely seen through this same gender lens. A Google search for Facebook's male CEO returns this message: no results found. As Gloria Steinem observed, whoever has power takes over the noun and the norm, while the less powerful get an adjective. Since no one wants to be perceived as less powerful, a lot of women reject the gender identification and insist, "I don't see myself as a woman. I see myself as a novelist, athlete, professional, fill in the blank." They are right to do so. No one wants her achievements modified. We all just want to be the noun. Yet the world has a way of reminding women that they are women, and girls that they are girls. In between my junior and senior years of high school, I worked as a page in Washington, D.C. for my hometown congressman, William Lehman. The Speaker of the House at the time was the legendary Massachusetts Representative Tip O'Neill, and Congressman Lehman promised to introduce me to him before the summer ended. But as the days ticked by, it didn't happen. And it didn't happen. Then, on the very last day of the session, he made good on his promise. In the hall outside the House floor, he pulled me over to meet Speaker O'Neill. I was nervous, but Congressman Lehman put me at ease by introducing me in the nicest way possible, telling the Speaker that I had worked hard all summer. The Speaker looked at me, then reached over and patted my head. He turned to the Congressman and remarked, "She's pretty." Then he turned his attention back to me and asked just one question: "Are you a pom-pom girl?" I was crushed. Looking back, I know his words were intended to flatter me, but in the moment I felt belittled. I wanted to be recognized for the work I had done. I reacted defensively. "No," I replied, "I study too much for that." Then a wave of terror struck me for speaking up to the man who was third in line for the presidency. But no one seemed to register my curt and not at all clever response. The speaker just patted me on the head, again, and moved along. My congressman beamed. Even to my teenage self, this sexism seemed retro. The speaker was born in 1912, 8 years before women were given the right to vote. But by the time I met him in the halls of Congress, society had mostly evolved. It was obvious that a woman could do anything a man could do. My childhood was filled with firsts. Golda Meir in Israel, Geraldine Ferraro on the Mondale ticket, Sandra Day O'Connor on the Supreme Court, Sally Ride in space. Given all these strides, I headed into college believing that the feminists of the 60s and 70s had done the hard work of achieving equality for my generation. And yet, if anyone had called me a feminist, I would have quickly corrected that notion. This reaction is prevalent even today, according to sociologist Marianne Cooper, who also contributed her extraordinary research assistance to this book. In her 2011 article, The New F Word, Marianne wrote about college English professor Michelle Elam, who observed something strange in her Introduction to Feminist Studies course. Even though her students were interested enough in gender equality to take an entire class on the subject, very few felt comfortable using the word feminism, and even fewer identified themselves as feminists. As Professor Elam noted, it was as if being called a feminist was to suspect that some foul epithet had been hurled your way. It sounds like a joke. Did you hear the one about the woman taking a feminist studies class who got angry when someone called her a feminist? But when I was in college, I embraced the same contradiction. On one hand, I started a group to encourage more women to major in economics and government. On the other hand, I would have denied being in any way, shape, or form a feminist. None of my college friends thought of themselves as feminists either. It saddens me to admit that we did not see the backlash against women around us. We accepted the negative caricature of a bra-burning, humorless, man-hating feminist. She was not someone we wanted to emulate, in part because it seemed like she couldn't get a date. Horrible, I know. The sad irony of rejecting feminism to get male attention and approval. In our defense, my friends and I truly, if naively, believed that the world did not need feminists anymore. We mistakenly thought that there was nothing left to fight for. I carried this attitude with me when I entered the workforce. I figured if sexism still existed, I would just prove it wrong. I would do my job and do it well. What I didn't know at the time was that ignoring the issue is a classic survival technique. Within traditional institutions, success has often been contingent upon a woman not speaking out, but fitting in, or more colloquially, being one of the guys. The first women to enter corporate America dressed in manly suits with button-down shirts. One veteran banking executive told me that she wore her hair in a bun for 10 years because she did not want anyone to notice she was a woman. While styles have relaxed, women still worry about sticking out too much. I know an engineer at a tech startup who removes her earrings before going to work so coworkers won't be reminded that she is, shh, not a man. Early in my career, my gender was rarely noted, except for the occasional client who wanted to fix me up with his son. Manly suits were no longer in fashion, and I neither hid nor emphasized femininity. I have never reported directly to a woman, not once in my entire career. There were higher-level women at the places I worked, but I wasn't close enough to see how they dealt with this issue on a daily basis. I was never invited to attend a single meeting that discussed gender, and there were no special programs for women that I can recall. That all seemed fine. We were fitting in, and there was no reason to call attention to ourselves. But while gender was not openly acknowledged, It was still lurking below the surface. I started to see differences in attitudes toward women. I started noticing how often employees were judged not by their objective performance, but by the subjective standard of how well they fit in. Given that the summer outing at McKinsey was a deep-sea fishing trip and most company dinners ended with whiskey sipping and cigar smoking, I sometimes struggled to pass the fitting in test. One night, encouraged by the male partners, I puffed away on a cigar. Just one of the guys. Except that the smoking nauseated me, and I reeked of cigar smoke for days. If that was fitting in, I stuck out. Others also seemed aware that I was not one of the guys. When I was named the Treasury Department's Chief of Staff in 1999, several people remarked to me, "It must have helped that you were a woman." It was infuriating. Their intent may not have been malicious, but the implication was clear. I had not gotten the job on merit. I also figured that for every person pointing out my advantage to my face, there were probably a dozen others saying it less politely behind my back. I considered my possible responses. I could explain that the last time I checked, there was no affirmative action for women at Treasury. I could mention that my credentials lined up with those of the men who had previously held this position. If there was enough time, I could recount centuries of discrimination against women. Or I could just slap the person across the face. I tried all these options at least once. Okay, not the slap. But of the responses I did try, none of them worked. It was a no-win situation. I couldn't deny being a woman. Even if I tried, people would still figure it out. And defending myself just made me seem defensive. My gut and the signals I received from others cautioned me that arguing the issue would make me sound like a strident feminist. And I still did not want that. I also worried that pointing out the disadvantages women face in the workforce might be misinterpreted as whining or asking for special treatment. So I ignored the comments. I put my head down and worked hard. Then, as the years ticked by, I started seeing female friends and colleagues drop out of the workforce. Some left by choice. Others left out of frustration, pushed out the door by companies that did not allow flexibility, and welcomed home by partners who weren't doing their share of the housework and child-rearing. Others remained, but scaled back their ambitions to meet outsized demands. I watched as the promise my generation had for female leadership dwindled. By the time I had been at Google for a few years, I realized that the problem wasn't going away. So even though the thought still scared me, I decided it was time to stop putting my head down and to start speaking out. Fortunately, I had company. In 2005, my colleagues Susan Wojcicki and Marissa Mayer and I all noticed that the speakers who visited the Google campus were fascinating, notable, and almost always male. In response, we founded Women at Google and kicked off the new series with luminaries Gloria Steinem and Jane Fonda, who were launching the Women's Media Center. As a former aerobics instructor, I was excited to meet Jane Fonda, and sucked in my stomach the whole time. From what I knew about the women's rights movement, I expected Gloria Steinem to be formidable and brilliant, which she was. But she was also charming and funny and warm, the absolute opposite of my childish image of the humorless feminist. After the Women at Google event, Gloria invited me to speak at the Women's Media Center in New York. I said yes without hesitating. The day before the talk, I headed to the airport with Kim Malone Scott, who ran the Google publishing teams. Kim is an experienced writer, so I figured she would help me craft a speech during the long flight. By the time I got through all of my backlogged emails, it was almost midnight. I turned to Kim for help and saw that she had fallen asleep. Long before Facebook made it popular, I thought about giving her a poke, but I couldn't bear to wake her up. Staring at the blank computer screen, I was at a complete loss. I had never spoken about being a woman in public before. Not once. I had no talking points or notes to turn to. Then I realized how striking this was, and that I actually had quite a lot to say. I began my talk the next day by explaining that in business we are taught to fit in, but that I was starting to think this might not be the right approach. I said out loud that there are differences between men and women, both in their behavior and in the way their behavior is perceived by others. I admitted that I could see these dynamics playing out in the workforce, and that in order to fix the problems, we needed to be able to talk about gender without people thinking we were crying for help, asking for special treatment, or about to sue. A lot poured out of me that day. Then I returned to Northern California and put the conversation on hold. In the following 4 years, I gave 2 talks on women in the workplace, both behind closed doors to professional women's groups at nearby Stanford. Then one day, Pat Mitchell called to tell me that she was launching TED Women and invited me to speak on social media. I told her I had another subject in mind and started pulling together a talk on how women can succeed in the workforce. A talk that TED later named Why We Have Too Few Women Leaders. Very quickly, I became excited. And just as quickly, I learned that no one else shared my excitement. Friends and colleagues, both male and female, warned me that making this speech would harm my career by instantly typecasting me as a female COO and not a real business executive. In other words, I wouldn't be blending in. I worried they might be right. Speaking at TED would be different from my previous keynotes. Although I would be addressing a sympathetic room, the talk would be posted on the web, where anyone could watch and judge and criticize. Inside Facebook, few people noticed my TED talk, and those who did responded positively. But outside of Facebook, the criticism started to roll in. One of my colleagues from Treasury called to say that others, not him, of course, were wondering why I gave more speeches on women's issues than on Facebook. I had been at the company for 2.5 years and given countless speeches on rebuilding marketing around the social graph and exactly 1 speech on gender. Someone else asked me, "So is this your thing now?" At the time, I didn't know how to respond. Now I would say yes. I made this my thing because we need to disrupt the status quo. Staying quiet and fitting in may have been all the first generations of women who entered corporate America could do. In some cases, it might still be the safest path. But this strategy is not paying off for women as a group. Instead, we need to speak out. Identify the barriers that are holding women back, and find solutions. The response to my TED talk showed me that addressing these issues openly can make a difference. Women forwarded the video to their friends, colleagues, daughters, and sisters. I began receiving emails and letters from women all over the world who wanted to share their stories of how they gained the courage to reach for more opportunities, sit at more tables, and believe more in themselves. One of my favorite letters came from Sabine Virani, a consultant in Dubai and the only woman in an office of more than 300 employees. She responded to my story about the executive who could not point me to the women's bathroom because, as she explained, in her workplace, the women's bathroom did not even exist. Sabine described how during her first week on the project, the client took her team out to dinner, but she couldn't join because the restaurant didn't allow women. Talk about not sitting at the table. She couldn't even get into the restaurant. Some of the men were openly hostile to Sabine. Others just ignored her. But rather than give up and transfer to a friendlier office, she decided that she could demonstrate to everyone that women are competent professionals. In the end, she won her coworkers over, and the client converted a bathroom into a women's bathroom just for her. She sent me a photo of her standing in front of a door with a printed sign that read simply and powerfully, "Toilets for women only." It was also enormously gratifying that men reacted positively to the talk, too. Dr. John Probosco of the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine told me that my story about women being more reluctant than men to raise their hands rang true for him, so he decided to do away with the old hand-raising system during rounds. Instead, he started calling on male and female students evenly. He quickly realized that the women knew the answers just as well, or even better, than the men. In one day, he increased female participation. By making one small change to his behavior, he changed a much larger dynamic. Major changes can result from these kinds of nudge techniques, small interventions that encourage people to behave in slightly different ways at critical moments. The simple act of talking openly about behavioral patterns makes the subconscious conscious. For example, Google has an unusual system where engineers nominate themselves for promotions, and the company found that men nominated themselves more quickly than women. The Google management team shared this data openly with the female employees, and women's self-nomination rates rose significantly, reaching roughly the same rates as men's. All the feedback from TED convinced me that I should keep speaking up and encouraging others to do the same. It is essential to breaking the logjam. Talking can transform minds, which can transform behaviors, which can transform institutions. I know it isn't easy. Anyone who brings up gender in the workplace is wading into deep and muddy waters. The subject itself presents a paradox, forcing us to acknowledge differences while trying to achieve the goal of being treated the same. Women, especially those at junior levels, worry that raising gender issues makes them appear unprofessional or as if they are blaming others. I have listened to women vent frustration over being undervalued and even demeaned on a daily basis at work. When I ask if they have aired any of these complaints to their superiors, they've responded, "Oh no, I couldn't." There is so much fear that speaking up will make the situation worse or even result in being penalized or fired. It seems safer to bear the injustice. For men, raising this subject can be even harder. A male friend who runs a large organization once confided in me, "It's easier to talk about your sex life in public than to talk about gender." The fact that he wouldn't go on record with this quote shows he meant it. Vittorio Colao, CEO of Vodafone, told me that he showed my TED Talk to his senior management team because he shares my belief that women sometimes hold themselves back. He also believed this message was easier to hear from a woman than a man. His point is valid. If a man had delivered the same message or even gently pointed out that women might be taking actions that limited their options, he would have been pilloried. Shutting down discussion is self-defeating and impedes progress. We need to talk and listen and debate and refute and instruct and learn and evolve. And since the majority of managers are men, we need them to feel comfortable addressing these issues directly with female employees. When a woman sits on the side of a room, a man needs to be able to wave her over to the table and explain why, so she will know to sit at the table the next time. Ken Chenault, CEO of American Express, is a leader on this front. Ken openly acknowledges that in meetings, both men and women are more likely to interrupt a woman and give credit to a man for an idea first proposed by a woman. When he witnesses either of these behaviors, he stops the meeting to point it out. Coming from the top, this really makes employees think twice. A more junior woman or man can also intervene in the situation when a female colleague has been interrupted. She can gently but firmly tell the group, "Before we move on, I'd like to hear what senior woman had to say." This action not only benefits the senior woman, but can raise the stature of the junior woman as well, since speaking up for someone else displays both confidence and a communal spirit. The junior woman comes across as both competent and nice. At Facebook, I teach managers to encourage women to talk about their plans to have children and help them continue to reach for opportunities. I give men the option of quoting me if the words don't feel right coming out of their mouths. Still, this approach is a bit of a crutch, and it does not translate to other companies. It would be preferable if everyone had permission to talk about this subject, both publicly and behind closed office doors. One stumbling block is that many people believe that the workplace is